Live from New York City, it's the Gary Mel Show. And now, your host, Gary Mel.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. We have an empowering hour ahead. No guest today. This is commentary day. I'll share my own commentary on how millennials, senior citizens, baby boomers, the next generation can work and should work together to take back power from institutions that have betrayed us all. And with that cooperation, we can make a difference. Also today, I'm going to give a couple of programs for those who are younger, who want to engage in something that would really make it a better world. And I'll give you three topics and the resources to follow up on them. Also, John Whitehead, Enough is Enough, Police Violence Plagues America. And then from our audio files today is the National Security Agency collecting all the data illegally in order to blackmail people. Did they blackmail Obama? An interview with the whistleblower, Russ Tice. Also, Heather McDonald, on how much more delusional can university students get. From firebrand Brendan O'Neill, it is a powerful speech on how millennials actually worship the establishment. And then I'll give a commentary of my own experience with Occupy, where there is a coalescing between the ideal that you're trying to establish, you're against something, but then what are you for? And what have you done to make that what are we for happen? As you see, we have a lot to do. I will be opening it up for calls in the latter part of the program. First, with the latest on health. This comes from the Annals of Internal Medicine and also from Psychotherapy and Psychosomatics, as published in Science Daily. And it talks about when we're at work and we're stressed by anything at work, maybe too much noise, maybe too many hours at work without a break, maybe too restrictive in that environment, meaning staying in our cubicles, that can cause stress. Here is the question then. Does that stress increase the risk of developing rheumatoid arthritis? This is a Swedish study, and it discloses new relationships between stress at work and the development of rheumatoid arthritis. Now, all of us know that psychosocial work stress, in terms of high psychological demands and low decision latitude, or the combination of the stressors, meaning job strain, is associated with an increased risk of several diseases. We've documented cardiovascular disease, but it has not been studied in relation to rheumatoid arthritis. However, research on the relationship between psychosocial work stress and immunological parameters also suggest an association with inflammatory conditions, including rheumatoid arthritis. So, what do we do? Well, first and foremost, just by bringing this scientific information to the awareness of the Human Resource Department, puts them on notice. You've been warned that the environment that we're working in must change. Then you share that information with all the employees and all management. And then you have a meeting to decide what can we do to lessen some of the stressors. Now, there's solutions for everything. Are we willing to make those changes? And if enough people realize that their heart conditions, their arthritis, their insomnia is due to poor work conditions, then you have the power in this current environment to come together and force change. So that's important. Also, nearly 40% of all breast cancer cases in the United States could be prevented if women kept a healthy weight and didn't have all the alcohol they're consuming, and if they exercise more. That's according to the latest study, and it reviewed 81 separate studies on the links between lifestyle and cancer. and it showed that 70,000 breast cancer cases could be prevented every year in the United States. Quote from the study, which was done through the American Institute for Cancer Research and the World Cancer Research Fund. And keep in mind, why is this important? 400,000 women die each year of breast cancer, 40,000 in the United States alone. We quote, "We are now more certain than ever that maintaining a healthy weight and being physically active and limiting the amount of alcohol they drink, women can dramatically reduce the risk of breast cancer." So now that's without looking at the things that we in the health field know. Mind you, the people in this study had no background in health, but we do. Here's how we can eliminate all breast cancer in those who are conscious of it, or at least the majority. Go on a plant-based diet. A healthy plant-based diet, you can reduce your risk by over 50%. Then exercising at least 180 minutes a week. That's not a lot. Also, taking certain supplements. The highest quality supplements are vitamin A, D3, vitamin C, vitamin E to prevent breast cancer. Include servings of cruciferous vegetables. There's your broccoli and cauliflower and beet greens and collard greens and arugula and watercress and radishes and mustard. Those are all terrific for you. Also, cayenne is great. Curcumin from turmeric is great. These all help with the prevention of breast cancer. Wine may curb toxic skin effects of radiation. This was first reported in Reuters, and we're talking about red wine. But then what is in the wine that's making this difference? And it's a relatively small amount, sometimes as little as 5 milligrams of a nutrient. I've spoken about 1,000 times on this program that I'm sure all of you know what it is. It comes from the grape skin and the grape seed, which is one reason it's always good to get Concord grape juice, because then you're getting the seed crushed with the skin, so all those anthocyanins and resveratrol amounts are all in there. So that's essential. So make sure that you get grapes, grape seed, grape skin by drinking grape juice. Now, grape juice is going to be about 10 times more potent in its anti-radiation effects than just drinking wine. So make sure that you get that in your system. On a daily basis, grapes are simply one of nature's most perfect foods. And by the way, if you can't find organic grapes, and they're not in season right now in most areas, take regular grapes and soak them with some hydrogen peroxide, and you rinse it and you agitate it and rinse it, agitate it 3 times. You can also buy what is called a veggie wash. Several different companies make it. And you spray it on, and again, you agitate it, because when you're agitating in a bowl of water, the parts of the skin that you're not seeing is being exposed. And then, much like an exfoliant, it'll take off the sprayed material. From Science Daily, published in the FSEB journal, a scientific journal, they're showing that the omega-3 fatty acids have a protective effect upon cardiovascular disease. And this was a team of French scientists who found that it doesn't take a lot for preventing cardiovascular disease. And it was identifying the most powerful factor, 200 milligram dose of DHA. Now, there are several different components of the omega-3 fatty acid, but the most powerful is the DHA. So anytime you buy any bottle, look at how much of the DHA you're getting. If you're getting 200 milligrams, that's terrific. And if you got 800 milligrams, that's even better. So try to get your DHA every day with your omega-3 fatty acids and help your heart. Coconut oil can guard against food bacteria. That's correct. According to the Times of India, an extract from coconut oil, this is called MONO, M-O-N-O, lauren, Laurin, monolaurin, could be used as a microbial agent in foods. Now, I've been using monolaurin to help people for decades. When I was working with 1,200 people with full-blown AIDS at the Tri-State Healing Center for 15 years, and not one of those people died during the period of time that they were there, and some were there for years, and 12 of them went on an accelerated program, and all 12 reversed their full-blown AIDS condition. We held a press conference. We had a group of scientists who reviewed all their medical records. We brought in doctors from around the United States with patients who would use non-drug approaches. And I'm not opposed to any drug being used for any disease, providing you show that A, it works, and B, it's not going to kill the patient. There are drugs that will work, but the patient dies. And AZT was a good example of that. But in any case, we were using only natural techniques and getting the best results of any clinic, any hospital, any place in the world ever on AIDS. And yet, guess who gets attacked for helping people with AIDS? You guessed it, because I wasn't supporting AZT, and there was a very powerful gay lobby that was aligned with the pharmaceutical industry and the manufacturers of AZT. In my opinion, a drug that has caused probably upwards of 300,000 people with AIDS to die, and I believe sooner or later, the people responsible are going to be held accountable. They've gotten away with that for a long time. But I was using monolaurin, among other things, by the way, because it had tremendous ability to overcome candida. And the people that have really collapsed immune systems, they have an overgrowth of candida in their intestines and sometimes their lungs, which they could die from, in their mouth. I remember one of the physicians calling me into his office, and a person was there, a man, who had come because he had heard a radio program about there were natural approaches to AIDS, or HIV, and we were talking, and the doctor took a tongue depressor and asked him to open his mouth. And the doctor took a step back, and in the guy's mouth, it looked like someone had stuffed, you know, like you open a vitamin bottle and they got little cotton, stuffed about 10 cotton balls in his mouth. And the doctor just took the tongue depressor and scooped out tablespoons of candida. This is yeast overgrowth. Needless to say, the breath was just terrible, and the poor guy would just be gargling every day with alcohol in a mouthwash. You don't want to use alcohol in a mouthwash. That only exacerbates it, makes it worse. And, of course, it immediately grows right back. But that person was completely well and never had any more candida within a week. And monolaurin and other things, especially wild oregano oil, colloidal silver, manuka honey, bee propolis, gargling several times a day with the slippery elm, many different things, and also drinking bitter melon and gargling with it. But coconut oil, everyone got it every day. Why? Monolaurin. So I just saw this study, and I thought it was interesting. This is published in the Journal of Food Science. So it's one way to help as a natural antimicrobial for foods. And by the way, every time I cook rice or beans, I always take a tablespoon of coconut oil and put it right in there. What it does in a very simple manner, it allows all of the grains of rice to be coated with the oil so they don't stick together. So you boil your water, you put in your coconut oil, you let the rice churn and heat up for about 15 minutes, and you bring your heat down. And then you don't put a lot of water. Generally, it's two parts water to one part rice. And then when the water is just halfway below the rice level, you turn the heat off, stir it, put on a lid, and let it steep out. And then you get nice, fluffy, non-sticking rice. And it also has that subtle coconut flavor to it. So you can make a nice coconut rice dish, too. But after it's all done, dicing up or shaving with a vegetable shaver, like you would shave carrots or celery or cabbage, you can shave coconut right into the rice. And then add some anise, fennel, into it in tarragon and stir it, and then put some lemongrass in, and then stuff that rice into a pepper or an avocado. It's a delicious extra treat. Even today, I just got an email from our team of chefs. I prepared, for the upcoming retreat, I prepared 16 original entrees, 16 desserts, 16 salads, and then they were perfected in New York. And since I'm out on the road, they would send photographs. And we worked on them until they were perfect. And this is one of those dishes, and this isn't even an entree. You can do this just as a noshing dish, meaning you make it, put it in a fridge, and then you have it as a snack. And so it'll be a lot of nice recipes. And by the way, in a couple of weeks, I'm going to be sharing a lot of recipes, including the photograph of the dish plated as a gourmet presentation, as a public service free to the audience each week. So you'll have a chance to expand your culinary skills by having beautiful photographs with a complete recipe and every dish. I never use a dish that the average person can't prepare it and have it look like it does on that plate, even if it looks like it steps out of the pages of Gourmet or, let's say, Epicure magazine. You can make these, and I believe we should. We should be far more interested in being little artists with our food, not just plopping down some rice and beans on a plate. Also, from the Times of India, published in the Journal of Food Chemistry, a cup of tea every day can prevent heart disease. That's correct. A study in Glasgow and France has led to the conclusion that both green and black tea, as well as raspberry, strawberry, and bilberry juices, help prevent fatty deposits from building up in our arteries. And this was a diet fed over a 12-week period. And so here it is. If you want to keep your arteries clean, you have a glass or two a day of green tea or black tea. Try to get the low caffeine. Also, they're mentioning bilberry and strawberry and raspberry. For most people, they wouldn't know what to buy. They're going to buy one of these sugary drinks. You should buy the concentrates that are sugar-free. But I would use different ones based upon my studying the science. I would use, first and foremost, blueberry. Wild blueberry is the single most powerful thing, followed by pomegranate. Blueberry, pomegranate, followed by strawberry. Do those and you're really helping your arteries. And maybe a tablespoon of each concentrate a day. Put it in your smoothie in the morning. And also, I mentioned the power of walking and exercising. Well, the latest study on this, quote, 30 minutes of brisk walking every day can significantly reduce the risk of breast and cancer recurrence. And you can walk briskly, but continuously for 30 minutes. And it increases your odds of living. And that was published in the Journal of the American Medical Association. And also the final study comes from New York University, and it says well-educated heart patients tend to have less faith in their cardiologist. Why? Quote, the relationship between hypertension and greater trust suggests that such perceptions may not be based on doctor competence. And they studied 1,000 patients who were highly educated. And this was published in the Journal of Evaluation and Clinical Practice. Now, let me give you an example. Every year, I have to get a whole battery of tests. I mean, everything. You can't imagine the tests they put me through. Everything in my blood is checked, my heart. And I always come out showing health. But when I speak with my physicians concerning what they see and ask them what they would recommend, I'm always curious. And they know that there should be a better diet, but to a person, they default back to, well, just as long as you're eating well and exercising, everything's fine. All right. But what would be the advantage of taking magnesium from, let's say, magnesium citrate at 600 milligrams twice a day, even three times a day? How would that help my heart? There are 315 different enzyme systems that are impacted by magnesium in your heart. How about 500 milligrams of potassium? What about L-carnitine, oxygenation of the mitochondria in the heart? They're clueless on these things. It's in the scientific literature, thousands of studies on nutrients helping the heart, diet helping the heart. They don't do it. So it's not surprising that the more educated a person is, the more likely they are to question the physician. And in fact, with vaccines, the one group of mothers in the United States who were most resistant to mandatory vaccines were a group of scientists working at Lawrence Livermore laboratories. Most had PhDs. So it's kind of interesting when the pro-vaccine posse is running around the networks spewing forth propaganda, not science. You never see them debate these parents because these parents have done their homework and they have the studies. And they're letting the science dictate the policies towards their own children. And that is something the mainstream doesn't have. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. We're going to take a break and come right back with some commentaries. Look forward to seeing you back here in 20 seconds. Wow. For the young people in the audience and millennials, we all should be supporting nonviolence, not just in schools and someone coming in who is clearly emotionally unstable, but we should start to have little groups. And you can do this at every school in America. Parents can do this as well, and I recommend that they do. Let's start to look beyond the headlines. First, let's learn some things. Ask, is there any evidence that the shooters were taking psychotropic drugs? If so, which ones, for how long, how many? Our experience and our research has shown that over 90% of all the killings, mass killings, these school shootings, the individuals were on antipsychotic medication, and one of the side effects is this psychoses. These people can go nuts. They want to kill other people and kill themselves. I've interviewed the family members. I'll give you one example of people who were arrested. I interviewed a father and son out in Utah. And the teenager was a model student and had a relationship, just, you know, your teenage relationship. And it didn't go well, and the girl broke up. And he was feeling sad. Now, he was an all-star athlete, and he was a four-point student. And someone recommended he see a doctor, and the doctor gave him some antidepressant medication. And then he was feeling anxious, so some antipsychotic medication. He says that he woke up. He didn't know where he was at. Well, he was in a jail cell. Why am I in a jail cell, he said. How'd I get here? Well, you took a rifle today to school and you said in your classroom, I'm going to kill people. I would never do that. Why would I take a rifle to school? I've never done that in my life. Now, he was a part of the Mormon community, and they brought in all the experts, the father did, and no one had any background that these medications can cause you to do these things. So he was not treated lightly by the judicial system out there. And in time, after being in jail, They brought in the experts to show that these drugs change your personality completely. They cause suicide. And indeed, we're seeing thousands of young people kill themselves. But then again, every year. But we're also, just do the math, all right? Here's what's amazing. Each day in the United States, every 24 hours, between 22 and 24 Americans commit suicide. But let's just go conservative. Let's go 22, the lower number. All right, and let's go 365 days a year. That gives us 8,030 people. These are military personnel using handguns mostly, sticking a gun in their mouth and blowing their brains out. Now, they've been doing this, are you ready for this? For over 18 years. So that means that's 144,540 Americans have committed suicide. They were all on these antipsychotic medications. That's the only thing the VA does. It provides them when they're in combat zones. Now, why? When was the last time you heard of a group supporting Stop the Raping of Men in the military? Now, there was a documentary about the rape of women, and it was a good documentary. I remember going down and seeing it at a pre-screening or early screening, and nothing happened because of it. There were some congressional hearings, but nothing happens in the military to clean up that environment of rape against women. But more men are raped than women in the military, especially in combat. Why would a man rape another man in a combat zone? That's a story that we should be talking about. That's something that's important. We're not talking about a few or a few thousand. We're talking about tens of thousands of men have been raped. Combat men. And yet it's not touched. The story is not touched because then you have to ask what goes on in a person's mind when they're not in a normal civil society. They're under pressure every day. And how many of these people are on medications? Oh, they're on medications? Yes. Anti-anxiety medications. Because there's such a fear of how quickly and easily you could go from being alive to maimed or killed. Well, why would that then cause you to want to rape someone? And why isn't anything ever done about it? Do you remember the photographs of Abu Ghraib showing those people humiliating the prisoners? Well, A, they're already prisoners. Nothing has been adjudicated. You don't know if they're innocent or guilty of anything. And more often than not, the vast majority were found to be innocent. So if someone already has been deprived of their liberty and they're being put into extremely hostile environment and you're already waterboarding them and beating them, why would you then go through the process of humiliating them, getting them naked, putting them in piles, having attack dogs bite their genitals? And not just a few. We're talking about hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. In fact, the Pentagon and Defense Department under Rumsfeld withheld 5,000 photographs. We only saw a few. I think it was like a dozen or two. There's 5,000 more. Nothing was done. They smack someone on the hand. They take a sacrificial lamb out of there, someone in mid-level, and nothing changes. So now we're finding out there's all these rapes. Why do men rape other men in prison? And yet it's an epidemic. Absolutely, we're talking about numbers that if you look at the numbers per prison and you look at how many people are incarcerated at any given time, and then you look at how many people have been incarcerated in total over the last, let's say, 40 years, you're talking about millions of men being raped. Now, in women's prisons, women are raped. Why is there no conversation? Why is there no hearings? Why is there no advocacy? Why are there no marches? Why are there no Me Too for this? Does that not count? Especially since the latest study showed that 39% of all incarcerated people should not be in jail. So you mean that the moment you're put in prison, the assumption of respect for that person's rights or body goes out the window and you can have anything done to that person and it's okay? So why don't we start doing some research about why people do what they do, how many people have committed suicide, how many teenagers have committed suicide? As sincere as your program is of wanting to have some form of gun control that could prevent with assault weapons, that could prevent these tragedies, why aren't you interested in doing something to prevent suicide? You have 10 times more kids committing suicide each year, your students, your friends, and almost always they're on these psychiatric drugs. Why not then ask for a boycott? If you're going to boycott someone, boycott the manufacturers. Are your parents on these medications? Are you on Adderall, the ADHD drug? Did you do any research on ADHD from the independent scientists to show that it doesn't exist? That an entire generation, the 10 million of you, I'm sure many who marched, you're being played, manipulated by the system, and due to the ignorance and hubris of your own parents? These are also important. And if you care about children, and I know you do, then why not do something immediately? Why not research the 50,000 children in Yemen who have died of starvation and disease just this year, just since January? All right? That's how many have died. 50,000? Yes. And Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and the United States and Great Britain are all responsible. We supply the intelligence. We have boots on the ground. We supply the weapons, the munitions, and the airplanes. So we are behind all this. So why not have all the young people in America who want to save the children in Yemen, and don't they deserve a chance to be saved? They have no running water. Whatever water they're drinking is dirty. They have no food. They're dying of starvation. Shouldn't they be given a chance to live? Shouldn't we have a Me Too for them? I think we should. I believe that we should support every child on the planet. And I believe that we have to pull back and see the larger picture, not just what happened at one school. What happened at one school is representative of what could happen at any school. So we have to look at the larger picture, and we have to start seeing what we, my generation, as well as our children, the X generation, and their children, the millennials, can do to save the children of Yemen, to save our classmates from suicide, to save the people serving in the armed forces from over 140,000 committing suicide, and also to save all the military and prison population from being raped. We already have a lot of laws, and we have a lot of awareness of rape in the larger society, but none of those apply to rape in prison or the military. We care about no one coming into our schools, and I believe we should have armed marshals in every school in America, because you won't know who a marshal is, just like on an airplane. You don't know that that person sitting there beside you is a marshal trained to stop any crisis or problem or terrorist on an airplane. Why not have one in every school? Do I think it's a good idea that all the teachers be armed? No, I do not. Do I believe that some people in that school should be armed? Yes, but you don't want to turn schools into prisons. You don't want people to feel that they're in lockup every time they go to school. So we have to pull back and look at what's going on at home, what's going on with the parenting, what's going on with the environment that allows someone to want to hurt another human being. We're not looking at the picture with a broad enough perspective. So a lot of young people in this audience and parents of young people, take a look at what's going on. 50,000 children died just in the last 4 months. And I'll bet that 99.9% of all the young people in America don't have a clue about Yemen, where it's at, and why we should be concerned. But we should. Now I want to go to an issue that it's always painful when you see someone pleading for their life. They're on the ground. Their hands are up. They're pleading not to be shot. They have no weapon. The police are fully armed, bulletproof vests. And they have assault rifles, and there's a bunch of them, and they just blow this person on the ground up. Then they end up getting off. What does that tell us about our system of justice? What does that tell us about how people are protected when they're doing something crazy? I remember I saw a video, and it was hard to watch, of a man who was on his own, bothering no one. He was in a part out of the city, and he was just, you know, minding his own business, and the police went up to see what he was doing. He has no arm, meaning he has no weapon, and there's a whole bunch of them. This is in New Mexico, and they just start shooting him. And they shoot him until they kill him. Not a single thing happened to the New Mexico police. New Mexico police get away with more murders per population than anyone else. It's like, I don't know what you'd have to do getting killed if you're unarmed in New Mexico. And by the way, it's not just people of color who are unarmed who get killed. Over 1,000 people have been killed, and the majority of those were not people of color. It's just that we have a culture where we believe that the police are there to protect and serve. The Supreme Court has shown that they have to do neither. They're not there to protect or serve. Now, we need the police, and the vast majority of police have not been shown to commit any crime against humanity or their citizens. In fact, I believe that most of the police care about their jobs. But what's about our screening and training session that we've militarized it to a point and we're getting people in who themselves have psychological problems, who are on meds, who are on steroids. And you start taking steroids, man, that can make you really violent. And so then it becomes a highly masculinized environment. And then why is it nobody ever shoots to, you know, someone in the foot? Why it's always a kill shot? There was a naked guy on a roof in Brooklyn. They shot him a kill shot. And the guy got away with it. A naked guy. How can you do a kill shot on a naked guy in Brooklyn? I forgot. You know, we have people who are allowed to become police officers without having the detailed screening and training. So that's unfortunate. That's an issue. In any case, I agree with John Whitehead that it's time that enough's enough. By the way, that enough is enough is a refrain chanted over and over by the thousands of demonstrators who gathered to protest gun violence in America. We need to do something about the violence that is plaguing our nation and our world. The world would be a better place if there were fewer weapons that could kill, maim, and destroy and debilitate. I think reasonable people agree with that. And on March 24th of this year, 200,000 young people took the time to march on Washington, D.C. and other cities across the country to demand that their concerns about gun violence be heard. I agree with that. I'm all for activism, especially since I've led dozens of marches on different issues against Monsanto, against nuclear power. But especially I support activism if it motivates people who have been sitting silently on the sidelines for far too long to get up and try to reclaim control over a runaway government. You've heard me mentioning recently that if you feed the beast, it will devour you. And we as Americans are not looking at the beast. For a long time, those of us who were considered liberal and progressive back in the 1960s and 70s saw the FBI, the National Security State, the CIA as enemies of the state. Even though they were part of the state, they were enemies of the people. They were unaccounted for anything. Phoenix Project, Operation Condor, the overtaking of governments. And I've shared that with you many times. No one was ever held accountable. Well, now many of those very same people have morphed into this odd, new, genetically strange creature called a corporate Democrat, the Clinton Democrat, where everything they do is proto-fascist, neoliberal, globalist, sell arms to anyone who can pay for them, make any deal with Wall Street. These people are utterly corrupt at every level of their being. And now they're wanting you to be in support of Comey and the CIA and the National Security Agency, as if these are models of democratic decorum and behavior. Did someone forget? These organizations have never been honest about anything. These are the deep state actors. Now they've shown themselves because they're paranoid against Trump that he couldn't be controlled, and they were afraid. They knew that Clinton would be completely controlled, as was Obama completely controlled. But with him, with Trump, no. So what we have today is we do not have anyone taking aim at the U.S. government as the greatest purveyor of violence in American society and around the world. I don't say that lightly. The systemic violence being perpetrated by agents of the government has done more collective harm to the American people and our liberties than any single act of terror or mass shooting. What do I mean? Violence has become our government's calling card, starting at the top and trickling down from the more than 80,000 SWAT team raids carried out every year on unsuspecting Americans by heavily armed, black-garbed commandos, and the increasingly rapid militarization of local police forces across the country, to the drone killings used to target insurgents. The government even exports violence worldwide, with weapons being America's most profitable export. Indeed, the day before thousands of demonstrators descended on Washington, D.C. to protest mass shootings, such as the one that took place at Stoneman Douglas High School, President Trump signed into law a colossal $1.3 trillion spending bill that gives the military the biggest boost in spending in more than a decade. Ironic? I think so. Here we have thousands of passionate protesters rightly raging, crying, and shouting about the need to resist the use of guns and restricting average Americans from being able to purchase military-style weapons. All the while, the U.S. government, the same government under Trump, Obama, Bush, Clinton, and Reagan, and even Carter, continues to act as a shill, all of them, and a shield for the military-industrial complex. And they embark on a taxpayer-funded death march that will put even more guns into circulation, and no one says a thing about it. Why is that? Why does the government get a free pass? Simple. $700 billion earmarked for the military, including $144.3 billion for new military equipment. You can expect a whole lot more endless wars, drone strikes, bombing campaigns, civilian deaths, costly military installations, and fat paychecks for private military contractors who know exactly how to inflate invoices and take the American taxpayer for a ride. You can be sure this financial windfall for America's military empire will be used to expand the police state here at home, more surveillance upon us, and then to target specifically all individuals who are activists or conscious enough to want to know the truth. They're going to put more militarized guns and weapons into the hands of local police and government bureaucrats who have been trained to shoot first and ask questions later. There are now reportedly more bureaucratic, non-military government civilians armed with high-tech, deadly weapons than our entire U.S. Marine Corps. And while Americans have to jump through an increasing number of hoops in order to own a gun, the government is arming its own civilian employees to the hilt with guns, ammunition, and military-style equipment, authorizing them to make arrests and training them in military tactics. And among the agencies being supplied with night vision equipment, body armor, hollow point bullets, shotguns, drones, assault rifles, and LP gas cannons are the Smithsonian people, the U.S. Mint, Health and Human Services, the IRS, the FDA, Small Business Administration, Social Security Administration, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, Education Department, Energy Department, Bureau of Engraving and Printing, an assortment of public universities. Did you know that they are all being armed and trained, even though they're civilians? That is the continuing expansion. Remember what I said, you feed the beast, it will destroy you. By the way, why do IRS agents need AR-15 rifles? Remember, it was just a few months ago that President Trump aided and abetted by his trusty Department of Justice henchman, Jeff Sessions, rolled back restrictions on the government's military recycling program to the delight of the nation's powerful police unions. And under the auspices of this military recycling program, which was instituted decades ago and allows local police agencies to acquire military-grade weaponry and equipment, more than $4.2 billion worth of equipment has been transferred from the Defense Department to domestic police agencies. Ironically, and while gun critics continue to clamor for bans on military-style assault weapons, high-capacity magazines and armor-piercing bullets and expanded background checks and tougher gun trafficking laws, the U.S. military boosts all these and more, including some weapons the rest of the world doesn't even have, with no background. In the hands of the government agents, whether they are members of the military or law enforcement or some other government agency, these weapons have become routine parts of America's day-to-day life, a byproduct of the rapid militarization of law enforcement. And over the last 30 years, police officers in jackboots holding assault rifles have become fairly common in small-town communities across the country. And we shouldn't think that that's okay. We do not need more SWAT teams. We do not need more police shootings. We do not need more militarized police. We do not need more violence in a culture already drenched in violence. Yeah. Enough is enough. I'm Gary Nall. Let us now go to our audio clip. And we're going to play this one. We're going to start by playing, let's go with Brendan O'Neill about how millennials worship the establishment.
Let's see how unrevolting or unradical millennials are. You just have to look at the EU referendum and the fact that a lot of them supported the EU. So what you had here was, and not only did they support the EU, not only did they vote for this corrupt, undemocratic, ossified, ridiculous institution. They also wept in the streets when it was defeated by the working classes, who they have no connection with whatsoever, most of them. So what you have is a situation where a lot of millennials, particularly the political ones, particularly the more active student ones, were on the streets fighting for, in defense of, this kind of staid, undemocratic, illiberal institution, which is supported by 95% of business leaders, which is supported by the IMF, which is supported by Richard Branson, which is supported by John Major, Tony Blair, Gordon Brown, Alistair Darling, I mean, every single member of the establishment, effectively. When you find yourself on the same side as those people, you know that you are not in revolt. You know you are not in revolt. There's no question about it. They were foot soldiers of the establishment. They were slaves to the status quo. And it was like, you know, they play at being revolting. They play at being radical, but then they come home for their dinner. You know, when push comes to shove, when the establishment is under attack, they come home, tail between their legs, they kind of brush their hair, do a side parting so their mum doesn't shout at them, and they vote, and they vote for the personification of the establishment in the 21st century, which is the European Union. So no, that tells you they are not revolting. There's no question about that. My beef with the millennials, and I realize I'm saying this as an old man from Generation X, my beef with the millennials is that to the extent that they are revolting, they're revolting against the good things about their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation, and they're accepting all the bad things. That's my real problem with them. So the good things that they are revolting against is, firstly, the idea of racial equality. We heard earlier about Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks. Do not compare yourself to these people, please, because the whole point of Martin Luther King's outlook on life is that people should be judged by their character, not their color. Millennials do the precise opposite of that. They encourage racial thinking. They are obsessed with race. They think you should interact with people depending on what color they are, what sex they are, what gender they are, what sexuality they are. You must constantly watch your language depending on the race or gender of the person you're dealing with. It encourages divisiveness and racial thinking rather than the kind of thing that their grandparents or their parents might have argued for, which is that character is what counts, not skin color. The other good thing that they revolt against is sexual liberation. One of the good things that came out of the 60s was the idea that sex could be fun, particularly for women who for years and years had been told that they shouldn't enjoy sex because it was just something that men enjoyed, not women. And the idea of radical feminists in the 60s and 70s was that actually sex was a laugh, it was good fun, and you should be able to do it whenever you want with whoever you want. The millennials are completely revolting against that. You can see this in their sexual consent classes, which are ridiculous. And also their whole argument against drunken sex, for example, or regretted sex or bad sex, all these things which they are increasingly redefining as rape because they, A, don't understand what rape is, and B, don't understand what sex is. So they're kind of very confused on that. And then the third good thing that they're arguing against is freedom of speech. The one good thing that the 60s generation and the 70s generation did was argue for freedom of speech, particularly in the countercultural arena, the idea that you should be able to publish literature and art and films and all those things, however offensive they were, that you should be allowed to do that stuff. They were very much in favor of freedom of speech. Today's millennials are not. Anything which they deem offensive or harmful or shocking, they will no platform, they will ban, they will rail against, whether it's Robin Thicke's song Blurred Lines, which has been banned on 30 university campuses. It reminds me of when I was at convent school and the nuns used to turn off the radio when Madonna came on. I mean, that's exactly the same situation. Or they banned the Sun newspaper because it used to have naked women in it and all these ridiculous, prudish, Mary Whitehouse-style things. So they revolt against those good things, racial equality, sexual liberation, freedom of movement, and they accept all the bad things about their parents' generation, completely uncritically. Like, for example, environmentalism, the most deadbeat, depressing, anti-human ideology you could ever imagine. They love that. They embrace that nonsense. And they also embrace the therapy culture. One of the worst things about the 60s, which is why I'm so glad I was born after the 60s, is that they were all into therapy. They were all into talking about themselves endlessly on couches. They completely buy into that therapy culture. They completely buy into the idea that human beings are fundamentally fragile and they need this kind of scaffolding of therapy around their lives in order to help them get through every day, effectively. And just on that, finally, on that point, what I really think that therapy question reveals is that they're not revolting at all. They're actually conforming to what their parents and their grandparents' generation expected, which is that you should constantly demand not freedom, but recognition. Not liberation, but validation. You must constantly ask officialdom and others to validate your identity, to validate your sense of mental ill health, to validate your victimhood. They are actually conforming brilliantly to the script written for them by that older generation in relation to the idea that people are fundamentally fragile and need constant help. In fact, I can't think of any other generation in living memory which has conformed so spectacularly to the older generation's expectations that they will be weak and pathetic.
That was only part one. Tomorrow I'm going to play part two. And you have an opportunity now to talk back. If you want to share points of view that you feel you agree or disagree with or other ideas, then those of Brendan O'Neill. And by the way, he has an interesting political background as a communist and as a socialist. And some of the things I would agree with, some I challenge. What I would agree with is that I've seen an awful lot of people, younger people, who say that they're against something. But then when I question them closely what they're against, for example, they're against the 1%. All right. Okay, that's fine. Be against the 1%. Which 1% are you talking about? What do you mean? Well, if you're talking about billionaires, there are about 3,075 billionaires in the world. If you're talking about billionaires in the United States, you're talking about just under 50. So that means 1,000th of 1%, 1,000th of 1%. If you're talking about people who have $1 million net, excluding their property, that's 10 million. Now, if you take into account their families, now you're dealing with 40 million people. 40 million people who can go to any private college and pay cash for it, can buy a house without any mortgage, never have to worry about having a car financing. They have no debt. Because they like to keep themselves solvent. So now we got 331 million people. Well, if you got 40 million of those, now you're dealing with 15%. Now, if you deal with the professional class, lawyers, doctors, engineers, accountants, CPAs, professors, you're dealing with people earning anywhere from $150,000 to $1 million, in which case they will live like the millionaire class, but they will do so more often than not with debt. Because they want their kids to also have the best. And And when you add them up there, you're dealing with over 69 million. And so between the two, you're dealing with 100 million people. So it sounds a little different than you say the 1% who controls everything versus the 33% that control. Even the math is wrong. We have categories of people who have inordinate amount of influence and control. If you want to talk about globalization, neoliberalism, those people who supported the European Union, I'm adamantly opposed to the European Union. I've studied it. I am for Brexit. I believe that Scotland, Northern Ireland, which is going to have a referendum about the getting out of Great Britain, and all of the individual countries would be far better off if they took back their own currency and took back their own economies. But the people, as he was saying, all the younger people who came from educated backgrounds or more affluent backgrounds, they supported the European Union. It's the working class that gets creamed and lied to and left outside of everything. Same way in the United States. So if you say, well, what do you think of a two-party system? The Democrats are supposed to be the party for the poor. It's never the party for the poor. It hasn't been the party for the poor in a long time. You know, they tell you they're for you, but show me the factories they kept in the United States. Show me NAFTA, GATT, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Show me all the treaties and deals they were making that excluded you and your interests. Show me universal health care that they should have and promised Obama and others, and they excluded and gave you this monstrosity, this profit-based system. Show me in the system who challenges the vulture capitalism. Right now, Puerto Rico, the airport's being sold off to Canada, half of it. All these, they're taking, I think, 140 agencies down to 35. They're going to privatize it. You think people in Puerto Rico have it rough now? Wait till every single thing in Puerto Rico is owned by an outside corporation. These are vulture capitalists. So when you're going to talk about something, at least do your homework before you talk about it. Because don't stand in front of me telling me you're against something, and then I see that you're eating the hamburger and drinking the cola and wearing the clothes and wearing the sneakers and using the cell phone from the very company you're supposed to be against. It, you know, that kind of conflation doesn't work for me. I believe that we have to have a new group of millennials coming forward who've done their homework, joined together, and work with others so that we can have a real good way of getting off the grid and taking back power for all of us away from the beast that we keep feeding by our ignorance and our indifference. I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank you all for listening. And tonight, the Progressive Comedy Hour, you talk about having a firebrand on. Whoa. 1 hour with Camilla Paglia. You won't want to miss that. 7 o'clock, prn.fm. If you've never heard her, you got to get put on your running shoes to keep up with how fast she talks. But she is one smart person and very provocative. Have a nice day, everyone.